Traveling the Vortex.
First, I want to talk about a little bit of news this week, actually, if you guys don't mind. The thing that I think I was most excited this week, and if you guys saw my blog post this week, toys was the theme of one of the days. And I think the thing I'm most excited about, and even though I'm not a Lego collector, I mean, I have some Lego collections, but Doctor Who, unfortunately, is not being licensed by Lego, but is being licensed by a company in the UK, and the bricks, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but the bricks are actually Lego compatible. So,
oh, nice.
You can actually buy these sets, and if you feel so inclined, you can add your Legos to them and embellish the sets a little bit. So I thought that was pretty cool that Lego actually got, Doctor Who actually got some toys that are Lego-like anyway, and I think it'll appease a lot of fans of Lego that they're at least, you know, interlockable.
I think what's fun is that when I was a kid, I always used to build Star Trek stuff out of my Lego bricks, and they're not Legos, they're Lego bricks. You have to say that. There's like a copyright issue. And I mean, my brother and I built fleets of starships, and unfortunately, you know, with the limitations of what was available, they were all very boxy. I mean, they were rectangular, squared off, and you know, the nacelles were kind of straight up and went back, and just nothing looked right. And I was so excited when the first Star Wars sets came out as an actual licensed, and they custom built pieces to make things look like they were supposed to. And I went, oh, they're going to do Star Trek next. We've had Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter. I'm pretty sure there was a James Bond set in there somewhere.
Prince of Persia.
I mean, where is the Star Trek Legos?
Paramount's holding out for too much money.
Probably.
Killing me.
So, I think it would be awesome if Lego actually did get the licensing to make the toys and then made a video game. Doctor Who video game.
A Lego Doctor Who, I would be all over.
That would be awesome.
Absolutely. That would be just incredible. Since it's not being licensed by Lego, that'll never happen. And that was one of my hopes was, Doctor Who video game, Lego game. But
don't you feel just a little bit stifled on your imagination, though, with Doctor Who Lego bricks? I mean, because what are you going to build? Well, this is the TARDIS. It's a box. I mean, that's kind of back to square one with these things, isn't it?
But you build the inside of the TARDIS.
Yeah, well, that's true. Console room.
But you can't play. You play within the console room, but you can't actually take the console room and spin it through the living room. That was one of the things as a kid that you do.
Build your own separate TARDIS separate from the console room, and you spin that
But it's a box! It was like the Millennium Falcon as a kid. You know, this toy was bigger than most of the children who played with it, and trying to lift that thing up and zoom through the house was impractical.
Well, I had it down to a science. They had the pegs that it stood on, the two on the back, which were the landing gear essentially, pulled down out of the toy, and you could retract them. Now the front was a handle. And it was perfect because you could rest that thing right on the center of your arm, and if you balanced it just right, you could fly that thing all over the house. It's kind of like holding it like a gun. It was the butt, and you just put it against your arm, and you ran around the house.
I had
that down to a science. So
it took me a while to figure that out. And initially, I was, you know,
holding it on each side,
wrapped around it, and it's like, this sucks.
But anyway, the other bit of news that came out this week was a company called Kids at Play is now producing a drivable Dalek, which I think is awesome. And if I can afford the silly thing, which looks inflatable, it looks like the mechanism that you drive in is obviously, you know, full-form little mini car type thing. And then it looks like the Dalek itself inflatable.
For the website preview, kind of it looked like it was an inflatable bumper
around
it.
Yes.
And then the inflatable
Dalek over-encasing. Yeah.
And a little plastic window in the front.
And it's new Dalek design, but they look awesome. And I'll tell you what, if I can afford the things and I can get them in the U.S., I will get one for my kids. Because I would love to see the two of them rolling around my driveway in Daleks. I just think that would be awesome. That would make my day.
Now, this is something I think is interesting, is how times have changed, because my initial reaction was the same. It was like, oh, that is so cool! And then the older part of me kicked in, and my girlfriend Mel said the exact same thing. She was like,
you wouldn't fit in that.
Are they actually promoting a toy to children that says exterminate all humans?
And I got true. I got concerned because over that. The video does say exterminate. I mean, it's just, it was like, whoa.
I was like, wow, this is kind of a violent toy. And I got concerned over that. And then I had to go, what is wrong with you?
It's a writable Dalek.
It's a writable Dalek.
So apparently I'm getting old.
Yeah, my first thought was, I can't fit in there. But I have kids, so.
I'd get in it.
But see, now you could put, you know, you could put kids in it and let them drive it around, and you get to be the doctor.
That would work too.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
Like, you know, knocking them over and throwing the kids everywhere.
Pushing them downstairs. It's a good thing that's inflatable.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's just, it's like safety bumping. Anyway, so that was the news that I wanted to bring forth this week. There's not a lot going on right now. Of course, we're in a dry spell. We're waiting a couple more weeks when the movie comes out, and I think there'll be a lot to talk about then, and obviously we'll review that when it comes out. But
and also waiting for season six to start, yeah. When things will really ramp up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we get little nuggets as they're filming and things like that. And of course, the Utah thing was big last year, and we had Christmas Carol we just came off of. But, yeah, a lot of that will ramp up later as we go.
We did get some feedback I thought we'd read. Draculasaurus commented on our Episode 4 blog entry. He said, hello, really enjoyed the show. Keep up the good work. By the way, here's how the multiple Moffats came about. It's actually three different last names. The man who played the fifth Doctor was named Peter Moffat with an E. When he got into acting, he changed his last name to Davidson to avoid being confused with the actor-director Peter Moffat with two T's and an A, looks like. Stephen Moffat with one T and an A. The current showrunner isn't related to either of them. And that's why Georgia Moffat has that confusing name.
Yeah, so thanks for clearing that, because we talked about that when we announced the engagement and pending pregnancy or pending babies for David Tennant and Georgia Moffat, and we were curious about how Dad's name is Peter Davison and Georgia's name is Georgia Moffat, and so we weren't quite sure where that came from. So Draculasaurus, we appreciate you sending that feedback in and letting us in on that. We really do appreciate that. And of course, if anybody hears anything that they want to correct us on or you know, inform us on in the world of Doctor Who, please, or anything really, just send us some feedback.
As is frequently the case, we will talk about things and not get it right. So
yeah, absolutely.
Or if you want to share your opinion on what we're talking about, send us the feedback.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can email us at travelingthevortex@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, or our website, travelingthevortex.blogspot.com. And we also have a Google Voice number.
And that number is 913-809-3025, and we're all giggling because we finally remembered to write it down, and then I had it at the end of my notes.
And I was stretching so he could flip to it in time.
I just think it's amazing that we're five episodes in. We've been doing this for over a month now, and we finally have the number in an episode.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. This is the first time we didn't have to say, check the show notes.
Yes. But if you forget, it is in the show notes.
Now, if you're driving your car listening to us, don't try to call now. Wait till you park, and then you can get out and call or check the show notes later.
Safety first.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, moving right along now, one of our charges was for this week is we went back and we delved into some classic Doctor Who, which is Keith's actually first foray into the classic Doctor era. What we did is, if you remember in the last episode, we talked about the Silurian, which we now have the correct pronunciation, thanks to the Doctor. Silurian.
Which I still think they pronounced it differently in the new season.
I don't think they said Silurian.
However we were pronouncing it.
I've always heard it's Solarian.
Solarian is what I was
watching these episodes. I was struck by that. It was like, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, just Silurian. Sounds
but anyway,
kinda cool. But...
We reviewed the Silurian episodes from season 5. And we thought it would be fun to go back and get a little bit of the Silurian history. And it's interesting because Keith, of course, had no reference point. He hadn't seen any of these episodes. Sean had seen a few, I believe.
I thought I had seen them. Going back and watching them in their entirety was an actual real treat for me because it was, again, you said memory plays tricks. I remembered bits and pieces of them. I wasn't sure that I'd ever actually watched them from beginning to end. And as frequently was the case with you and I growing up, that you may not have got them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
This is what we had. We showed it.
And when I was a kid, the Pertwee era was few and far between. They actually started in Tom Baker's era. That's what became popular in the United States. And every once in a while, my PBS station would go back and pick up and show some John Pertwee. So actually, from my point of view, I had actually seen Doctor Who and the Silurians, but it had been so long ago that a lot of it escaped me. And so that was a refresher for me, probably the most that episode. Even later than that, in Davison's era, I did see, and I think this was probably towards the end of my childhood viewing, when I started to fall off of Doctor Who closer to high school, but I had seen Warriors of the Deep. And then the Sea Devils, I actually had seen most recent, and I think I've only seen about 10 years ago, had gotten a copy and seen that when I had kind of, come back into my Doctor Who phase as an adult. So they were all kind of sparse. And as we kind of talked about pre-show, everything kind of melded together for me because I think, I kept telling you guys a little bit of what I remembered of the Sea Devils and really realized that, the mind cheats. And I was actually remembering things from Warriors of the Deep that I was attributing to the Sea Devils, and then going back then finally watching the Sea Devils, realized, wait a minute, no, I this was stuff that had happened in Warriors. So, yeah, it all kind of blended together in our minds, but we've gone through the episodes now, and they're all fresh in our minds somewhat. And I have to say that because
some
people didn't finish their homework, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Well,
but
I think most of us didn't finish their homework.
Most of us didn't finish their homework.
Glenn's the only one that actually went back and watched all of the Sea Devils.
Ironically, and that's the one that I remembered the best.
Yeah.
And had seen most recent. So, anyway, let's start with Doctor Who and the Silurians, which is the first episode that we ever see the Silurians. Of course, it was Third Doctor John Pertwee story. Takes place with UNIT and has his first companion, Joe Grant. And, first of all, we'll talk about, I think that, barring going through and just giving the plot of each story, I think as we talk about the things that we saw and review the episode, I think we'll kind of relay that story as we go along. But I want to get your guys' first impression, because, especially Keith, because this is his first classic Doctor. Now, Pertwee is now your first classic Doctor, which is unique because I think a lot of people start with either Tom Baker or Peter Davison because they're a more familiar Doctor. And of course, Sean and I growing up, our first Doctors were Tom Baker. Mm-hmm. It was just, that was how it was. So I'm interested to hear what you had to say.
Initially, I was kind of put off by Pertwee, but throughout Doctor Who and the Silurians, I really grew to like him. Some of his mannerisms and his snark. I really liked his snark. And then as I watched the beginning of... So I didn't watch all of the Sea Devils. I watched the first... almost half of it. I kind of was like... I really like Pertwee as the Doctor. He does a good job. Despite the weird frilly outfits and the random cape.
He's quite flamboyant. At least in his dress. Maybe not so much in his mannerism, although he can have a bit of flamboyancy as well. But remembering back to a lot of the costumes that Pertwee went through, they're very, very out there.
As for the episode goes, or the story arc, rather, I have a hard time calling it an episode because there were 7 episodes.
Well,
it's
the story, sure.
Yeah, the story. The story was good. You could tell that they really dragged it out in spots where it didn't need to be and tried to fill more time than necessary. But what's really interesting is if you pay close attention and if you've watched the recent Solarian episodes, all they pretty much did for the recent ones are remake or adapt.
Reimagine
yeah. and adapt the story from the first one. Because there's a whole lot of elements that come back up in the new series.
Yeah. I think the parallels being, you know, obviously in the original, you've got a nuclear reactor that reawakens the Silurians. They've discovered this energy source, and it's enough to be able to bring their numbers out of hibernation. And, of course, in the Hungry Earth, you have the miners that are drilling down and sort of awaken the Silurians that way. So it's an awakening. It's technology awakening that the two different races of Silurians. And so that's, you know...
There's the one Silurian that wants to make a deal and live on the surface with the humans, and the one that doesn't want to.
And the one that wants to make the deals is an older Silurian.
Yes.
And the one that is the more militaric is the, and you know, wants domination, is a younger Silurian, which I thought was an interesting parallel as well.
Eventually dies.
Yeah.
But, of course, the difference here is the one that wants to make peace in the older episode ends up getting killed by the one who doesn't want to make peace. And the one that doesn't want to make peace takes charge. So that's quite a bit of a difference there. But then their whole, okay, we're going to go down into hibernation, and a lot of the doctor's interactions with them were very similar to what happened in the new series. But there were a whole lot of elements that were added to it that wasn't in it. And for being 1971... the story, I was really impressed by. I really liked the story, despite the unnecessary filler.
Yeah. It really felt like they were trying to stretch it out to make it seven episodes.
And those times where they were trying to stretch it out really gave it a B-movie feel to it, whereas when you were really into the meat of the story, it felt more like Doctor Who. So there were times of it where it felt like a human and two robots should be sitting in an aisle of chairs making fun of this thing because of the music and some of the dialogue and some of the plot and the effects. But then there were other parts that genuinely actually felt like Doctor Who to me because the story was so good.
Yeah. Very well written.
It should be noted that Keith and I watched the Silurians together, and I did my duty as a Who fan. And we opened with an apology. This isn't what you're going to be
I'm never apologetic.
You almost have to in some ways, just because
believe that you should always prepare a new viewer, but I never apologize. I never apologize for that.
It's a little hokey. It's very dated, and just wanted to warn about that. I did fill him in on the backstory of why is there no TARDIS? I mean, we've been exiled to Earth, and kind of went through that whole bit. And then, we went from there. And like I said, there were many, many, many moments that I don't remember from this compilation of episodes. And I'm not sure I've ever actually seen all of it in its entirety. So it was a new viewing experience for me as well. I've always enjoyed Jon Pertwee. He's among my favorite doctors, just because of the, like you said, the snarkiness and the little quips that he has, and his just general relationship with all of the unit family. I never report myself post haste or forthwith. just little moments like that really make it worthwhile. We obviously see the introduction of Bessie, which was kind of a big moment for the series, since he's going to be here on Earth. Might as well give him some cool tool around in. And I agree. The story, for being a 1971 story. Now, all of the unit stories...
And Earthbound.
All of the unit stories aren't necessarily present-day Earth. It's kind of implied that this is...
Slightly
futuristic. Yeah. Not necessarily,
There's some unit dating issues that I think we'll revisit someday. Yeah. But there are two impressions you can take, that either this takes place in the 1970s, or it does take place sometime in the near future.
Right. At least from the 70s.
From the 70s.
So probably more like present day.
Hence David Tennant's comment in, I think it was the Centauran episodes, where he said he worked with UNIT closely in the 70s, and then he says, or was it the 80s? And I thought that was such a clever line because it so addressed the continuity issues. But again, we digress. We'll go on to that later. But
there were many, many, many moments in this when I was really struck by, despite the flaws, despite the, you know, and we joked the other day, the last episode, about the cardboard sets. And that was something that we were all struck with, I think, with all these episodes, was that there are no cardboard sets. I mean, went out and they found locations where they built sets that were flabbergastingly impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, they should particular.
They should have taken a little bit of the budget from the sets and put it into the costumes or the makeup.
But the story is, you know, coming on the heels of the 50s and the cinema of the science fiction, when you've got Earth versus the Flying Saucers and you've got all of these invasions, alien invasions, constant, nonstop, and they're all terrible. They're all horrific beings from Mars intent on destroying everything under the sun. And all of a sudden, here we've got this story of aliens that have already been here. They're not aliens. They evolved on the planet. They had the planet first. They just went to sleep, and the quote-unquote apes took over.
Yeah. Well, it's the Silurians make mention that they foresaw the moon essentially coming in and changing the dynamic of the Earth. And
going to impact.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. The planet.
They didn't realize
they saw
it was just
moving closer and thought that.
Which, and just the fact that in 1971, they were so bold to say, okay, evolution. Humans came from apes. In 1971, on television, of all places, that is
in
such
a kids' show.
A bold thing to say, even if it is a bit subtle. Much more subtle than it was in the new series, but to an adult, you can still pick that up and say, oh, they're saying that we evolved from apes, these guys evolved from reptiles, and we shared the planet. That's just such bold storytelling for 1971.
Let me pose this question, and I'm not sure. Is it, though, because we're American viewers?
That could be.
We have more of a pure Puritan, especially in the 70s society.
This
is airing in the United Kingdom, and I don't think there was so much that's true. Stigma there, so maybe that's why
it very easily
it
could
happens
be.
In the 1970s in the UK.
For all of our, I mean, I think the three of us especially consider ourselves a fairly open-minded group of people, but there's still things that, you know, while I applaud any time somebody wants to step out and do something, you know, a little shocking or a little different or a little unusual on television, especially here in the States, because they don't, there's still that little bit of, really? You're going to go there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's just a little bit of it. And we just took that away from it, that we were just surprised that, wow, okay, cool. I mean, it's a very, very progressive, forward-thinking episode.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Well, and just for, of course, it could just be the American part of it, but just the idea of evolution hadn't fully ingrained, at least in America at that point in the 1970s. It was still kind of being introduced, and a whole lot of people were dismissing it still. So the fact that maybe London is more progressive.
Well, maybe they were pulling a Star Trek with it. You know, just the fact that it's science fiction, in quotation marks, you have free license to kind of get away with things that you know, you can come out and have an alien who's half white and half black on Star Trek and talk about racial discrimination, and nobody gets it because it's science fiction. It's like, really? But you know, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it just it falls under that umbrella.
The people that would take issue with it discredit it at the same time because it's science fiction.
Right. But just the fact that we've got this race here on the planet, they've been here, and yes, there is some intent to conquer and destroy, and instead of the typical hero from the 50s B sci-fi movies who is a scientist and invents the blah 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 ray that's going to destroy them,
techno babble,
we've got a guy who's like, no, let's go talk to him, let's solve this peacefully, let's see what we can do about it. That's unheard of. I mean, again, Doctor Who's a little different show. But it was so cool to see that. And obviously, you know, I know the Doctor's not going to go down there guns blazing, but it really reinforced, especially surrounding him with this whole military mindset from UNIT, and that they're going to go down and kill everybody. And he's the guy who's like, no, let's wait and see what happens here. Let me go do this. I just found the whole story to be really, really interesting, and a very fresh take on, you know, that kind of concept.
Well, and the whole germ warfare that the last couple of episodes deals with. I mean, there might have been germ warfare going on or being developed at that time, but I don't think it was as well known about or as much of a fear.
I don't know. I think germ warfare has been a fear since World War II, and I mean, it's part of the Geneva Convention. It's part of the, you know, Hitler obviously experimented with germ warfare. I think maybe it sort of buried itself and resurfaced later. But no, I think it was probably on the minds of a lot of people at the time.
Oh, it was a concern in Vietnam too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think they were afraid that the Viet Cong would utilize germ warfare as well. I think it's always been on the public conscious. Maybe further removed from us because we didn't really ever live through, you know, a major war like that. We've had the two Iraq wars, but. And
and I'm quite a bit younger than you guys.
Yeah,
so.
Even in the first Iraq War, for the first Gulf War.
Thanks for pointing that one out, Keith.
Even in the first Gulf War, I remember a lot of concern about germ warfare. But it might have been an ebb and flow thing as well, where maybe in the 70s it wasn't so much thought of. And because we're all sort of product of the 80s, Sean and I, of course, born in the 70s. But, you know, maybe that is, in fact, that, yeah. But to go there and utilize that idea of something that may not have been.
I don't think it was very often used in the 70s.
You don't see it much in old film. Yeah, I would agree.
You really don't even
in
see
films
it.
Films from the 70s, 80s, you don't see that idea. And I see it in that placement. Yeah, you're probably right.
Most of the time now, the only time you see that is a zombie movie.
Yeah, that's true. And that's really
that's what it's become now.
Return of the Living Dead. That's a 1960s film, though, or the Night of the Living Dead is a 1960s
Night of the Living Dead,
film,
but so. They didn't really address it like
No, they
that.
Don't. And it's really explained away later. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I think the bottom line is we're all real impressed with Malcolm, is it Hugh?
Hugh, I believe that's
with
right,
With Malcolm
yeah.
Hugh's writing. And, again, moments of, ugh, really? The papier-mâché dinosaur.
Which in comparison to a later...
Well
in comparison,
we'll get to
it's
that.
Pretty nice, yeah.
We'll get to that.
That was one of the things I hadn't remembered about the episode, was the dinosaur. I remembered clearly the Silurians throughout the whole thing, and as menacing as they were. The costumes aren't the best. I mean, they're Doctor Who rubber suit, but they're not.
Well, I mean,
they're not really that bad.
I equate the Salarian suits to the Gorn suits in Star Trek.
Sure, okay,
but
a
little better actually. Look, having seen this, because the mouse did move,
right,
and then the third eye lights up,
yeah.
And they couldn't move too well, but
which I thought was interesting that. For being
Homo reptilia. They walk so stiffly.
At least humanoid based. They walked so lumberingly. I mean, it was just like it took one guy 5 minutes to get across the cave. I mean, it was just the base. That seemed very odd, and maybe it's because of they're looking for that Frankenstein's monster lumbering.
Yeah,
monster, because that's what you think of when you think of monster, but. It just seems so out of place for this scientifically advanced species that's predated humans on the planet, and they have all this science, and they have obviously this telepathic killing ability and all these telepathic powers, yet we still rock side to side and menacingly as
their
as
joints
an
must
old
still be
film.
Stiff from sleeping.
Perhaps that would be that
from hibernation.
There's a good way to retro retro.
I buy
that.
What I find really interesting is they walk so stiffly. Like you were talking in Doctor Who and the Salarians and Warriors of the Deep. They walked very much like that.
But the Sea Devils.
Not the Sea Devils. That was one agile little creature.
Absolutely, yeah. I
Maybe
the
it's
same
the
thing.
Fact that the Sea Devils in Warriors of the Deep are wearing their samurai outfits and this guy is all in his knitted tunic or whatever the heck he was wearing. But maybe that adds extra mobility.
Could be.
I want to touch briefly on the how much I had forgotten from the original classic Who was sound effect based, where it was meant to imply whatever was going on at the moment. And it got to the point where we were starting to Mystery Science Theater this episode a little bit.
We did quite a bit once your roommate
all,
got there.
It's all, hard not to do when you get a group of people,
when you get a group of people
watching classic Doctor Who.
The ringing phones.
Oh.
There was not a single ring. It's a telephone. That's all it does. Not one of them did that. All of them twerped, beeped, hissed, whistled.
It was a constant. It was a constant one-tone sound.
But they were all different. And even the same phone made a different noise every time.
I suppose since they all looked identical, that was to differentiate which phone was ringing at what time.
The first time it happened, this noise went off in the conference room, and nobody reacted to it. And I sat up on the couch and went, is this a sonic alert or something? What is the? Maybe there's an intruder. What's it? And then the Brigadier reaches over and picks up the receiver. And I was like, oh, okay, it's a phone. Really? All right. And then it happened again and again and again and again. And it didn't matter where they were at on the base. It didn't matter if they were in the hospital. Every phone did something weird.
It doesn't help, though, that the...
Doorbell sounds like a phone ringing.
Incidental music in this episode is all electronic. And sounds very similar to all of these special... there was times that I couldn't tell the audio effects apart from the incidental music.
Absolutely.
In fact, there's times where the incidental music makes a certain tone that I was wanting the Brigadier to answer the phone again until I realized that that incidental music carried over into the next scene and bridged the two and realized, oh, wait, that's what they're using for music there. So that was almost just...
I give them a lot of credit for using such electronic music in 1971. I mean, think of the... one of the very first full electronic MIDI songs hadn't fully come out yet, if I remember correctly.
MIDI's kind of made their ground later on.
And of course, the fact that they were using pre-MIDI technology to make this music is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and of course they're doing tape loops to make that, and they're using old style machinery to make this. And yeah, I've listened to some interviews, and I can't remember who interviewed at one time, but he talked about the introduction of electronic music, and that they actually didn't recognize the BBC music department did not recognize electronic music as music. In fact, when it was in the early days, if it was utilized, it was still under audio effects, and that part of that was unionized and old style or old fashioned musicians that didn't agree with this, that you're using something besides musicians that are part of a union that are to be paid. And so it's very interesting that the electronic music is starting to make a surface here and utilized so much. So I think that's one of those things that it was a bold move in the 1970s to go along those lines with that type of music.
Which, and from what I watched of the Sea Devils, the incidental music didn't seem as bad.
No, I would agree.
It wasn't as cheesy.
It still seems very electronic, but not near as bad. Well, since we're talking about audio effects, I think one of the things we have to address is the every time that the Silurians use their third eye, which for some reason in the Silurians, the third eye makes a sound and flashes any time that they're using their
telekinetic
abilities. Whether it's to kill somebody, or whether it's to stun somebody, or whether it's to open a door.
or put a wall back together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put a wall back together or destroy it.
But the sound that made was so grating and so frequent in those episodes that really was one of the things that I disliked about the episode. And so much so that I talked to you guys pre-show about this as well, but my daughter was in the same room, and she was on the computer and playing video games or something. And at one point...
And tell them how old Caitlin is.
Oh, she's 7. Okay. My daughter is 7 years old. She turned and said, I can't remember exactly how she said it, something to the effect of, they don't have to use that music here. They don't have to use that sound anymore.
That can stop anytime.
Yeah, that's what she said. She said, that sound can stop anytime now because she was just annoyed of hearing it. Now, she's not watching it in context. She's just hearing it off to the side. But it just,
even in context, it was a little
absolutely
annoying.
Even in context, it was annoying. So that was one of the things I could have done without maybe a different choice from the audio department. But
I thought it was interesting, and we touched on this briefly. I think it was first episode when you mentioned... Well, the doctor lies, mm-hmm. To suit his purposes. And at the time you said it, I kind of went, eh. But watching this, he goes to the guy's house, he finds the doctor dead, Dr. Quinn, and he comes back, and he's giving his report to the powers that be, and the general undersecretary, permanent undersecretary, and conveniently doesn't say anything about the dead scientist at his house.
Yeah.
And right in the middle of this, well, maybe we should listen to you. the woman comes in, they kill Dr. Quinn, and we have to go to war. And you just see the look on his face like, wow, that came back to bite me, didn't it?
Just... Clearly, though, that made the point, though, that the reason why the doctor refused or withheld the information is probably exactly the reaction that the other doctor that comes in and says that Dr. Quinn is dead, and is the reaction is that's invoked by that is, we have to go to war. They've attacked us, you know. And the doctor was trying to stay away from that mentality, because that's the interesting thing about this whole episode, is the doctor wants to communicate with this new species, not new but old but found species, and wants to, you know, realizes that they hold a lot of scientific information that the humans probably don't even have any grasp of, and how much knowledge they can gain from the Silurians, and how they can, you know, regain peace with them, and the Silurians can live, you know, on the surface together, and he wants to broker this peace. And throughout this whole thing, you've got this military presence of UNIT, you've got this major, I think it was Banks, Major Banker, who is the head of security for the nuclear facility, who's just gung-ho all through this thing. You know, he's the first one that takes a shot at a Silurian. Mm-hmm. He sees the humanoid figure, takes a shot, and of course then is attacked by a papier-mâché dinosaur. But it's called off later, you know, as well. He's also the first one, after he gets out of the hospital, or sneaks out of the hospital, or to charge into, you know, battle with them to go down there, and then of course is, you know, subsequently captured, and the virus is, you know, released through him, because he's forced the virus, obviously bringing it to the service. It was just this whole mentality of the doctor's peaceful approach and everybody else's militaristic attack first approach.
Well, and that's also one of the parallels from the new series that they carried over, is the fact that humanity kind of sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to your, I thought the same
thing.
It's
the same kind of ending. And from what I didn't get to finish the Sea Devils, but from what I read at the end of the Sea Devils, kind of the same thing. Because they end up bombing. I don't know if he tried as much to make peace with...
When we get to the Sea Devils and I talk about the review, there's actually a different approach there to the Sea Devils.
Okay.
But let's finish the Silurians, and we'll move on to the Sea Devils after that. And I'll explain what I mean.
The other thing that we joked about... that I think in a way kind of came as a surprise, in a way it didn't, is the final episode where he set the reactor to overload, and he's going to wipe out the Silurians and the Silurians, and apparently the human presence in this area as well, because they were like, oh, good bluff, and he just kind of says, oh, I wasn't bluffing, I actually had to do this, because otherwise they wouldn't have bought it. Well, can you fix it? I don't know, maybe. And I chuckled to myself, and Keith and Mel looked at me, and I said, well, what, we've been talking about this nuclear reactor for 7 episodes now. You didn't honestly think it wasn't going to go into meltdown, did you? I mean, come on. So then we've got this mad dash to finish it. And he's under the table, and he's rewiring something. And I was shocked, because, well, first of all, any time they take the doctor out of costume, it's always a little jarring in a way. You put him in a spacesuit, you put him in an environmental suit, whatever you're going to do with him, okay. Here's Jon Pertwee, and he shows up in his flamboyant with the thing and the cape and the whole bit, and we chuckle. And then he spends several segments in the miner's outfit with the white hat and the rope and everything.
Which I found really interesting, the fact that he put that on, because Matt Smith, he wouldn't have put that on. He'd just run down there. I mean,
might have put the helmet on.
Maybe
that's
put the helmet
it.
Yeah. on, but that's
well, he
it.
Likes hats. So,
yeah, David Tennant, from the impression of what I've seen of him, would just kind of run down there. He wouldn't necessarily take
the Satan pit. He
well,
wore.
Yeah, Tennant has a couple of episodes where he wears a spacesuit with a full blown helmet, and he also
and
wears
lights.
A tux in a couple of episodes, which is a little different.
Well, but if a full blown spacesuit's a little different from wearing a hard hat.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
There's
a difference between taking safety and, if I don't put this on, I literally will die. I mean, it's a little bit different. So I found it really interesting that Pertwee put on the whole guard with the rope and everything.
Yeah, he was ready to climb some mountains.
I talk about not going too far ahead here, but in the Sea Devils, he goes into this base, Sea Devil base, pretty much unprotected as well. So, I mean, it's like, we just threw it. It didn't do me any good in, you know, Silurian. So, well, I would just stay in my regular clothes.
Well, and then later he's curing the disease, and he's got the full white lab coat smock on. And they're very careful about what they're doing, although nobody was wearing gloves. So, you know, all right. And then later, okay, now I have to rewire this nuclear reactor. And he's in a t-shirt and white pants. He's in a sailor outfit or something. And it was like, with the exception of, obviously, Eccleston, which was kind of a different costumed approach anyway, I've never seen the Doctor in a t-shirt.
Yeah.
It was just jarringly weird. There was just something about that image. And then Keith points out, he said, does he have a tattoo? And we all kind of stopped and looked. And sure enough, he's got a tattoo on. And you have the backstory on that. We had to do some research on this.
First of all, you ask me if this tattoo, which strikingly looks like what to you?
From the position of him on the floor, it's on his arm, it looks like a question mark. To me, it looks like a question mark. And Keith says, I think it's a snake. And it probably is a snake, but we found out that John Pertwee does have a tattoo. The actor does. But I kind of thought to myself, well, they've gone with the question mark motif so much in some of the later Doctors. Wouldn't this be kind of a cool...
precursor?
Just kind of a cool little character thing. This has always been there and nobody knew about it until, you know, you go back and review it and listen to podcasts.
Well, I'll let you in because I did a little bit of research. And I found out that obviously, as some of us know, John Pertwee was in the Navy.
Her
Majesty's Royal Navy. And I guess at one point, he and three other guys went on a drinking binge and got incredibly schnockered. And the next morning he woke up and had a tattoo on his arm. And the tattoo is that of a cobra. So that's the real world explanation for the tattoo on the arm. But interestingly enough, I didn't catch that when I watched it. And it wasn't until you brought it up and we were looking tonight pre-show that we found that still from the show. And darn tootin', if I first looked at it and didn't think it was a question mark as well, even knowing that it was a cobra, I thought, oh, I totally know why you thought that would look like a question mark, because it really has that.
It's got the shape. And
he's upside down. He's not upside down, but his arms clearly are upside down, and you see the coil, and it really does. It looks like the question mark.
Well, I think why I thought it was a snake and you guys thought it was a question mark was because you've seen the other Doctors with their question marks.
Yeah.
I hadn't at that point.
It's not really a reference for you, yeah.
Yeah, so that's why I would automatically go to, well, why would he have a Riddler logo tattooed on his arm? Let's go to a snake. That makes a bit more sense.
He could really like
the Riddler.
One other shout out for Joe, the Dr. Stalwart companion in this episode, and the incredibly short miniskirt that she was wearing in the first episode. Want to throw a...
That's Liz.
Liz, pardon me, not Joe.
Yeah.
Where was I going with
Little Liz. Earlier.
Good choice on the part of the costumes.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought some of the things that struck me about the episode was, and I had to, even though the... Dr. Lawrence, the director of this nuclear research facility, you don't like him at first, because he wants to get this nuclear reactor back online. He doesn't want UNIT's presence there.
He's Niter.
And why is a power drain on a nuclear facility any reason to send UNIT in to investigate? Because it's my impression that UNIT is the... what's it stand for? It stands for... now it's like Unified Something Task Force.
Unified Nation International Task Force.
In the day, it was United Nations International Task Force. But weren't they tasked... Or maybe I'm just blending in the new rules for them... Wasn't UNIT tasked with unexplained and mostly extraterrestrial,
they couldn't explain the power drain.
Well, I suppose that's true, but
people died in the caves.
Because
they didn't show up after the people died.
They gave the Brigadier kind of it was almost a throwaway line when he's complaining to him initially about, why are you here? And he says, well, you've been having this, this, and this happen. He goes, yes. And he goes, that's why we're here, because it's unexplained and it's something that... you know, is vital to national security, so...
Okay,
we got
I'll buy that.
It
just
but
seemed,
it's
seems
a stretch.
Strange to send UNIT there. Now, obviously, it's a convenience because it's a Doctor Who episode, and obviously it's going to be something, you know...
If you haven't figured out the formula by now, Keith, the Doctor lands somewhere and bad stuff happens.
It's the Buffy quote, Dawn's in trouble, must be Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely. So...
so you don't like this director, and he's mad because they're meddling, and he wants to get this thing online, and he wants them out of the way. But you almost feel bad for him that none of it, you know, when they set this episode up, I almost feel like that occasionally Doctor Who will go the route where the person in charge is aligned with a outside source for nefarious means.
Right.
And I almost felt that this is where they were going to go with this. And then at the point where he comes in and he's infected and he has that passion speech about how they ruined his life, that until they came, until UNIT came and stuck their nose in this, everything was fine. And I really felt bad for Dr. Lawrence in that place. But it was almost like that was pulled for that added filler of the episodes, because really Dr. Lawrence, other than being this, you know, guy that's kind of in the way, there really was no purpose for him.
Other than to deliver
great lines like, you don't mean to take apart a 15 million pound device with a screwdriver, do you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was good writing, and they did well incorporating him, but it seemed strange, and I actually felt bad for the guy when he's on his death scene talking about how this has ruined his life.
And they turned the Dr. Quinn character into the one involved.
He was. And that was another thing that I was going to bring up, is he goes to this communication chamber in the base, in the cave base, that seems to be removed from the Silurians. Obviously, it's two different locations. And then it sort of troubled me that we never revisited this location.
Yeah, we did.
It was there.
I got the impression that when the doctor went down and snuck in and was watching them around, like, looked like the same computer to me.
That, you're right. What set it off is the chair. That satisfies that. That's right, because the chair is still there.
Which, did you recognize the chair?
Looked like it was from Beetlejuice to me.
No, but it was. I'm 90% certain, in a case of reusing props, I'm 90% certain it's the same chair that they strapped Tom Baker to in Android Invasion. That's kind of got that reclined thing with those arms.
With the large arms, yeah.
I'm 90% certain that was it.
That could be. And well, we'll do some research, and if somebody just knows, send us feedback, because that'd be...
But I got excited when I saw it. I was like, I know where that's from! Or, well, I guess this is where it's from.
You mentioned the line about the screwdriver, and I found it interesting that after watching what I have of the new series and how reliant the Doctor is on the sonic screwdriver, the only thing in all of this I've watched... There is one mention of the sonic screwdriver, and it's just the fact that he can't find it.
He's misplaced it.
Yeah, and so I found that really interesting and kind of refreshing in the fact that he wasn't having to rely on, oh, okay, that fixes it, or that explains it.
Now, having said that, how many segments of this 7-part arc could we have cut out?
That's very
true.
If
he had it, because he would have had to spend all night checking the equipment. He would have run a woot, and okay, it's fine. He could have got out of the jail cell at any point in time when he's incarcerated by the Solarians.
He could have figured out
He could have fixed the reactor.
Well, now what you're doing, Sean, is you're justifying the overuse in the new series.
I'm not saying that. Be careful what
you say.
There's a difference between overuse and stretching it out for 3.5 hours unnecessarily.
I also have to give a quick shout out to my roommate James Heckard, who joined us. I don't know, it was about midnight. He came in. We were probably in about the halfway through the second or third episode. He sat down and watched with us for just a little bit. And Jeffrey Palmer shows up as permanent Undersecretary Masters, and immediately he walks in the room, and James goes, "Hey, that's the guy that played that general in Tomorrow Never Dies." And we looked at him, and we looked at the TV and went, "Oh yeah, it is him." I have to say, I hate him, because James has this ability to do that.
Yeah.
Here's this actor; it's 30 years later that he recognized him from what amounts to a bit part in this Bond movie, but he was able to pick him out like that. Now, you and I talked about it later. That obviously, as time goes by,
that's the interesting thing is I picked him out right away. Now, I didn't watch this particular episode with you guys. I watched this one on my own because I had other commitments, but I recognized him right away as well. But part of my background is I used to watch As Time Goes By, which is a British situation comedy that they air on PBS here in the United States from time to time. And interestingly enough, and I let you know this little fact, is he was in As Time Goes By with Judi Dench. And that was the neat thing when I saw Tomorrow Never Dies, is that Jeffrey Palmer and Judi Dench are both in that scene, in that pre-opening sequence of Tomorrow Never Dies. And I thought that was incredible that they paired those two back together for that. I thought it was kind of a nice nod to their relationship in the other series. So,
just had to throw that out there.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I think that I wanted to point out is I love the reference to the interesting relationship that the Doctor will have off and on with UNIT, even though he's working as a scientific advisor. He and the Brigadier seem to have a very good relationship in this. Yeah. He clearly, as the second Doctor, the Brigadier and he were great friends. I mean, they really came to be very close and had some disagreements, but you know, they at least had, you know, that going for them. This is John Pertwee's second episode. This is the third Doctor's second story.
Yeah.
This followed Spirit and Space, which was the Regeneration episode or
story. Yeah,
first story. And so we haven't established the third Doctor's relationship, even though it carries over with UNIT. But they really felt like, you know, they were old friends. They had disagreements at times through this through this story. But the ending, just the look on the Doctor's face when he, you know, his idea is to wake up these Silurians individually and broker peace, you know, still continuing the peace idea. The threat has been thwarted, so his idea is to wake them up one at a time in a controlled environment and discuss, you know, peace and learn things about them and whatnot. And of course, the Brigadier says, "Oh, absolutely, we're going to go along with it." And as the Doctor and Joe Grant leave, the bombs start Liz.
See, you
got me doing it. Yeah, Liz Shaw leave. You know, the bombs go off, and clearly the Brigadier has his orders from the Department of Defense to destroy this, nullify this threat entirely. And just the look on the Doctor's face is just, and I think it really sets up the patchy relationship he'll have with the militaristic ideals of UNIT and the Brigadier, and his idea of pacifism and peace and trying to learn about, you know, these other species. And I thought that spoke a lot, and I really liked the ending. And ending it like that, you know, a lot of times you have the Doctor Who's that have the nice little joke happy ending, and sometimes you have the Doctor Who's that really kind of leave off as their own semi-quasi cliffhanger and work it into the next story, you know, where there's just a bridge over because there's very little time between the two. And this was one of those times where they left it on a stoic note. And I liked that. I thought that was really cool.
It was very jarring, really.
It was.
To go through all of this and get to that point. And just the look on his face was, you know, a shock, disbelief, betrayal. All of that swarmed through there. And it was really well done. Although, now, the Brigadier made some reference to, after the Doctor leaves, he makes some reference to the fact that they are to seal it off forever. And so we blow everything up, and we're under the impression that tons and tons and tons of rubble have come down into this cave system
to
them, or at the very least seal them off,
bury them.
And as Keith and I pointed out, it's like we've seen them walk through walls just by shaking their ears and flashing their third eye and making that awful noise. What did they think they were going to accomplish with 10 tons of rubble?
Absolutely.
It was very much a typical, well, those guys will be back moment. Just thrown in there.
But. Which, and one more thing about this episode, and a little bit, this can kind of be a transition into the Sea Devils. I mentioned this when we watched it, and we had mentioned it previously in the podcast, that the TARDIS almost is a third character. Mm-hmm. And it really was a little strange to watch a Doctor Who show, knowing that it's Doctor Who, and there's no TARDIS in it. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit reassuring when we got to Warriors of the Deep, the TARDIS re-emerged, but I just thought, as a new viewer, it was really...
Why he's here.
Even with the setup, it's...
It's a little disjarring.
It's disjarring. It just felt a little off. I think that also contributed a bit more to the B-movie aspect to it, because there isn't the TARDIS to make it truly feel like Doctor Who the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. I see what you mean.
I think maybe I'm used to that first at least season and a half of Pertwee's era, where now that I've revisited a lot of it, that I'm used to that those Earthbound stories, and so I don't see that as much, but I can see that coming from a new viewer, and that's interesting. Well, let's move on and segue into Doctor Who and the Sea Devils, which I think I'm the only one that completely watched, got the homework out of the way.
In fairness, it's made, not that I didn't
Keith
want to.
Keith at least made an attempt.
I tried.
And
we should point out, it's not that Keith only got halfway through it and didn't like it.
No, yeah, I just didn't have the time to finish it off.
You know, we work, we
trying
have school,
to
we have...
obtain the episodes.
Well, and that was the thing, is no one we knew had a copy of the DVDs. We had to procure, by other means, some of the copies we watched.
You can edit this out if
Warriors
you want.
Warriors of the Deep was actually purchased from iTunes, and we managed to get copies of the other ones. It just took us a long time, and so that kind of put our schedule off as far as watching those.
Well, the interesting thing is, I think I actually owned a copy of Doctor Who and the Silurians on VHS once upon a time. I think it was one that I purchased, and of course it sat on the
no,
shelf.
No, you had the
collection.
Sea Devils. You had this. That's where. That's why that, I've seen it most recently.
It was a two-part.
It was.
Disc,
it
or,
certainly
or,
was.
Tape set.
And that's why I had seen it most recently, because I borrowed it from you. I remember that now.
All right. So if anybody, if we have a rich benefactor out there who would like to donate DVD copies of all these episodes,
well,
to
that
the
being
show,
said, that being said, I certainly will now own this box set. I mean, I obviously would own it anyway because I'm a completist and we'll have all of it someday anyway. But this will be one of my next purchases when I'm able to get this, because. We'll talk about this when we get finished with the stories, but let's move into the Sea Devils, because I'm going to be talking a lot. I'll be the one talking the most on this one. But this one's interesting because the Master, the Doctor, and now we're at Joe Grant.
Now we're Joe.
Go to visit the Master, who is being kept in a facility. He'd been thwarted in the demons, had been locked away here on Earth, and kept, you know, heavy watch on, and so they go to visit him, and as soon as they walk in the room, there's this relationship thing going on, like this courteous thing, where they're talking like they're old friends, even Joe, in a way, you know, it's like this civil conversation, and they're, you know, they're having this chat, you know, as though they've been longtime buddies or something, still, you know, adversaries, but just...
Well, the Doctor does kind of make reference to the fact that you could say that we went to school together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And as a new viewer, I have no idea who or what the Doctor is, and I kind of had to take away the fact that, okay, this is a Time Lord, because he asks where his TARDIS is.
Well, that's the other thing going in this one, you didn't have enough setup, because, does ask where the TARDIS is, and I think that's the neat thing about this, is that... Now, knowing it's been a few years, I believe the TARDIS is still, at this point, I could be wrong because there's some gap here that I'm forgetting, but I think he's still earthbound. He's still trying to repair his TARDIS now.
Looking at the BBC website, the Sea Devils was one season later.
Okay, so we're still earthbound. We're still in a broken TARDIS, tethered to the Earth, and I thought it was interesting that one of the Doctor's motivations to see the Master, not just to check on how secure he's being held, but to see if he could get him to tell him where his TARDIS is so that he can get the part that he needs in order to escape from Earth, you know, and move on and do his thing. So I thought that was interesting, and the dynamic between the Doctor and the Master was really, really interesting at that point. So,
and Keith had asked me in advance, knowing, well, the Master's in that, you know, what do I need to know? Is there anything? And I feel bad in a way, because I didn't necessarily blow it off, but it's like, well, the Master's one of those villains that you don't necessarily need the entire setup, because he is in a lot of it, especially in the Pertwee era. And eventually we will get to some of these episodes. But he's an enemy that can kind of come and go, and we've talked about the Moriarty aspects mm-hmm. of him mm-hmm. to the Sherlock. And I didn't really realize until we started kind of going through some of the setup for this, that a lot of the John Pertwee era is the Master returned. I mean, he's very, very much a regular character.
Well, the Master's introduced, if I remember correct, in the Third Doctor's era.
Yes.
Although
they've
I
made allegories now that he may have been Autons? Around earlier.
But, yeah, no. But, they certainly have been, but to viewers, to who viewers?
To, yeah. in filmed episodes.
Yes, he was introduced in the Third Doctor's era, and so they utilize that a lot. I think that that's the reason, because the Holmes to Moriarty dynamic, yeah, we know what I'm saying, dynamic, and because it was an Earthbound story, you can't always have the alien visitors coming to Earth. And the Master, you know, being the slick guy that he is, introducing that and having a you know, dark and light adversary hero relationship, I thought, well, that was, I think that's why they focused on a lot of that, especially.
Yeah, he very, very much there. And I kind of feel bad in a way that you didn't get any setup. They just go to visit this guy in prison, and you're probably going, all right.
Well, I'd heard reference to the Master, knowing that the Master was the Moriarty character to the Doctor. What I watched of the Sea Devils, that was the most interesting part to me, was the Master stuff. I really didn't care about the Sea Devils. By the time I stopped, they had revealed that it was the Master's plan to
awaken
the Sea Devils.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. But that's about as far as I got into the story arc.
Well, and that's really what it is. I think it's a Master-Doctor story. I don't think it's so much the monsters in this one. I think the Sea Devils were a...
pawn.
Or a useful device in order to... you know, a plot device for the Master in order to carry out his plan. I think it was an idea to revisit a Silurian-type idea from the past where you've got Earth-bound... predating, or earthbound creatures predating humans, and bring them back and utilize that same idea of taking over the Earth, taking the Earth back from the humans, from the apes, as they like to say.
Which, and they make reference to the fact that the Sea Devils aren't in fact Salarians; they're more like Salarians' cousins,
yeah.
Where they evolved in a different locale, so they evolved differently.
Yeah, it's one of the allusions. One of the things that they alluded to was the fact that the Salarians were reptilian, and that the Sea Devils were more of a amphibious species.
Yeah.
So, but that they were still related in
which likes knitted time. Sweaters apparently.
And of course, yeah, the tunics. You did have a problem with the tunics.
I think
you said that quite frequently.
That was so... it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah. And it goes back to the... we talked about the lumbering Silurians, and then we go to the Sea Devils, and they're very spry. They're very agile. They're running, and they're moving.
I was impressed with how quickly he was moving,
yeah,
and climbing up
really
the ladders.
They
and
did. They
move on that base like commando SWAT
absolutely.
Team.
Well, you got two factions of six coming out of the water at some point too in the episode, and of course it's the same six guys in rubber suits that they've shot twice, so that it looks like there's more of them, of course. But yeah, they move coming out of the water is a little awkward, because I imagine with
the rubber,
30 pounds of rubber costume on you trying to get out of the water coming out of a quite docile sea, or not docile but agitated sea, as I mentioned, that's got to be kind of tough. But they certainly move around and get going. But no, I really think this is a Master episode. The Sea Devils are a plot device. But we do learn a little bit about the Sea Devils. We find out about their plan to also take over the Earth, take it back, reclaim the planet. We have the dynamic of the Doctor trying to communicate with them and establish peaceful relations with them. Coexistence is another theme again for the Doctor. And of course, the military is deciding to, we've got to destroy this. And that actually happens early on, where the attack I can't remember the guy's name. He's the, he's like secretary, he's with the Ministry of Defense.
Not the damn secretary.
Yeah, he's with the Ministry of Defense, and he pretty much calls on the captain to... or the commander to, launch the attack. And that actually happens halfway through, ironically enough, while the Doctor and the Master are in the Sea Devil base, the Doctor's trying to broker an agreement. And, of course, the Master's trying to convince them that he's lying and that they need to attack. So you've also got the dynamic of the Master, who's wanting to take over as well and utilize them, is trying to convince them to attack. And so that happens midway through. And then, interestingly enough...
while the Doctor and the Master end up back down in the sea base at the end of the episode, the Doctor is the one that takes the final approach to wipe or essentially seal off the Sea Devils this time in order to prevent war. And that's when he comes out of the sea after they've done this and they escape. That's the point he makes, is that, you know, that was the approach he did, because what he does is he overloads their system, their device that they're going to use in order to overthrow the humans, and overloads it and reverses the
polarity
of the neutron flow, which we discovered is the one of only two times that John Pertwee actually used all of that. And we talked about in the Silurians how he makes reference to a form of that sentence, but it's not those words exactly, which are credited to the John Pertwee era very heavily, and that he only said it, you know, twice, or once in his own era, and then once, of course, in the Five Doctors. So, but interestingly enough, I caught both times he mentioned reversing the polarity in both episodes, and I thought, oh, it's so Pertwee, and, you know, not knowing.
Wait, so that he reverses the polarity when he overloads the system?
He reverses the polarity of the neutron flow. What it is the device is that the Master convinces the Doctor to help him create this device that would bring the rest of the Sea Devils out of hibernation. Well, the Doctor agrees to help the Master to do it, but his idea is to alter it so that it sabotages, essentially, their plans, so that they can't come to the surface and raise their...
When he's trying to fix the transceiver when they're on the base, or so that he can transmit instead of receive, he also mentions reversing polarities.
Oh, yeah, he does. He does mention it there as well. I love that scene. And in fact, that's another thing I like a lot about this episode is, number one, the chemistry between John Pertwee and...
Roger.
No.
Joe?
Joe Grant.
Or Joe Grant.
What's her name?
I don't think it matters.
The Third Doctor and Joe Grant's chemistry and relationship is great. I had forgotten until I've gone back and seen recently The Green Death and things like that, that they really had a great chemistry. And you could tell they enjoyed each other.
Yeah.
And maybe even, you know, off camera, but on camera, the two get along so well and they make such a great pair. And I've lost my train of thought of where I was going with this, but... the comedic elements in it as well. There's a lot of neat little laughable things that aren't over the top, silly, but they're fun. And one is when he fixes the transmitter and finally gets to work, and he says, you know, he's pretty much praising himself for getting it done, and then it blows up, you know, his hands. It goes poof, you know, kind of smoke comes out of it. And I thought that was a neat little comedic element as well.
Katie Manning,
that's right. Joe Grant. Sorry, Miss Joe Grant. Wonderful actress, and did a superb job when she resurfaced in Sarah Jane Adventures in The Death of the Doctor. I just stunning woman back then, and she's just a fine actress. And I'm killing time while I look at my notes because I can't remember some of the other points I was going to make about the Sea Doctors.
One of the things, and I pointed this out to Keith, that this is something very, very big in the Pertwee era, was the production's ability to go on location and marshal the entire armed forces of Great Britain for whatever they were doing out there in the Highlands. It didn't matter. They had helicopters and tanks, and the one scene I remember is at the end of the Sea Devils, the Master escapes on the hovercraft.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like...
Well, Joe gets to drive. Joe and the Doctor drive the hovercraft at one point,
as a kid, hovercrafts are cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big boat, and it just takes off. And, you know, just seeing... Here's Doctor Who, who's also cool, on a hovercraft. You don't get any better than that. It's just a nifty thing. And they had a lot of that in this era.
Yeah.
There was just constant military involvement. Obviously, it had to be with UNIT, but I'm just... The fact that they got it... for a low-budget show is really impressive.
One of the things I like about the Sea Devils, and even more so than the Silurians, we talked about the real-world sets and how great it was, and you didn't see wobbly sets, you didn't see the same thing with this, because I get the impression a lot of this was actually shot in and around the castle, so a lot of it was shot seaside, and it was shot at a post for the Royal Navy. And in fact, a lot of the shots where they're actually on the ship is all U.S. or not U.S.
Her Majesty's Royal Navy. They're actually, I did some research and found out that the U.S. Navy, or U.S., the Royal Navy actually waived the fees that they used on some of the stock footage because they were, you know, so excited to be on there and they were so cooperative and they thought this would be a good publicity stunt, you know, stunt for the Navy to show how, you know, great they were because, you know, kids are watching Doctor Who and it makes the Navy look good. And in fact, a lot of the extras in this were unpaid naval servicemen and that are in the background. And of course, some of the real actors are stuntmen within there in Navy costumes, but they're actually a lot of the extras. And they utilize this, I don't remember what they call it, but it looks like a battleship that they're on at one point. They obviously utilize this diving mechanism that they put the Doctor in to lure him to the bottom of the...
Oh, and he's an expert diver.
Yeah, expert diver. Yeah, absolutely.
I remember that.
Yeah, the commander makes reference to that. And
part of his jack-of-all-trades nature.
But yeah, and then obviously...
The Doctor is always an expert of whatever he needs to be.
Yeah. Obviously on the naval base, that's Navy stuff too. So I was really impressed with the on-location shooting with this one as well. And Keith and I talked a little bit about this earlier. One of the things I thought was interesting is the fact that they've got the Master locked up in this, you know, maximum security castle, essentially, this most dangerous man, you know. And at one point, the Doctor battles him with swords that are hung outside of his cell. Why are there swords just hanging outside of his cell, for one thing? But a terrific sword fight scene. Oh, I loved it. It's very enjoyable. But Keith pointed out that something that I hadn't noticed is that these must be fencing foils because at one point the Doctor puts the foil into at the Master's chest, and you actually see the
ball.
Yeah, the ball on the end. So... That's an interesting bit of information. And also this had one of the most interesting cliffhangers, actually one of the best cliffhangers I've seen in Doctor Who and forgotten about this, that at one point the Master procures a knife from one of the soldiers, and at the end he throws it at the Doctor, straight at the Doctor, and that's where they cut. And you think, oh, now, clearly remembering, I know that the knife, you know, it's the wall next to him, yeah, and it doesn't
right
hit him.
His head.
But it was one of those moments. You're like, he just threw a knife at the Doctor. I mean, violently throws a knife at the Doctor. And I thought that was just one of the best cliffhangers I'd ever seen for, you know, separating some parts of an episode. And then to go on to say, I had, as we talked about the memory cheats, I had remembered, or had thought I remembered the Silurians being in this episode. And then, of course, now watching it, realizing that they weren't. And then I think what happened is I then was remembering Warriors of the Deep incorrectly and merging those two together, some of the plot lines, which Warriors of the Deep is actually the show we got, the episodes that we got to watch together as a group, which was a lot of fun. And
It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed watching these episodes. The story, I don't think, was quite as good.
We skip forward now to Peter Davidson's era.
Yeah,
I didn't enjoy Peter Davidson as much as I did Pertwee.
Did not?
I did not.
Okay.
I liked Pertwee better. I can't pinpoint why. Honestly, I wasn't that impressed with his companion.
Tegan and Turlough.
Tegan and Turlough. I wasn't too impressed by them. Tegan just seemed to get in the way all the time.
Tegan was good at that.
And then there's the whole Merker.
This is one of those things where I've talked about the memory cheating, and a lot of times the memory cheats the wrong way. A lot of times you remember something you watched as a child that you really, really, really liked and you thought was one of the greatest things you'd ever seen. And then you see it later as an adult, and you go, oh, why did I think that was so good? That's so horribly bad. This was one of those things that I remembered watching this when I was young, thinking how crappy it was, and that it was just really not a good episode, that the story was bad, we had wobbly sets, we had bad monsters, and actually revisiting this now the other night, I really kind of enjoyed it more this time, enjoyed the story, thought it was good. But the Merka still sticks out.
And we just had to laugh when the thing came on because it's the two guys in the rubber suit.
We either need to include a picture when we post this blog entry or for this episode, or if you're listening to this and don't know what we're talking about for the Murka, go Google it.
It's probably truly one of the worst monsters, not in Doctor Who, in TV history.
This makes the papier-mâché dinosaur look really good.
What's fun, too, is when it shows up, and you know, there's something outside the airlock, and they cut to the Doctor, and Peter Davison goes, "Oh, the Murka." And he's very concerned about it, but you could almost read it the other way, that he's like, "Oh, we're going to have to deal with that thing now." Like, he's disappointed that this is what they've sent after me. All right. And it is. It's obviously a horse type suit where you get the two guys in the suit, one in the front, one in the back.
Panama
I think
horse.
there may have been a third set of legs in there.
Yeah, it almost looked like it.
A tail.
I was just a rather large butt on it.
That could have been as well.
That was a really big butt.
Seaweed beard and a tall neck head.
That looked like Kermit the Frog.
And the emergence of the Murka as it busts down the foam rubber doors. Which, again, you know, props to him for thinking outside. I mean, how do you bust down a door? How do we give this bulkhead, this watertight, but we're in an undersea base, we've got a watertight bulkhead, and this thing's got to bust through it. How do we do that? Foam rubber! And just...
Well, that's...
Okay.
That's the problem is, we have... When this thing opens on this really great design of a set. In this real open, two-tiered set that they've clearly had to build in a studio, because this is all enclosed, there's no outside. And they did such a great job on this set, and it looks fantastic. And even the corridors look great, you don't see the walls wobble so much, you know, it looks good. Until the Murka. And when the Murka comes in and starts, yeah, as you said, tearing down this foam rubber door... It looks horrible.
I wonder if the actor was pushing a little harder than he was supposed to and causing it to wiggle. And
well, I think the idea is that you use foam rubber so it looks like it's bending the metal.
Oh, yeah, but it still could have been pushing too hard.
As he pushes, it kind of does what foam rubber does and just wobbles.
And they've changed the appearance of the Salarians a little bit in this one.
They've altered them.
Fins and their third eye, all it does is
what happened to the telekinesis?
Yeah, the telekinesis disappeared, and all it does is flash when
talk,
they talk.
As we talk, we flash.
And they develop buttons, which, hey, that could be an evolutionary step for the Salarians. They have buttons now.
Is that we watch Warriors of the Deep together, and Sean says, was it Sean or was it you that says, Sean says, "Why? What's the deal with the buttons? Why don't they just use their little flashy eye thing to open the door?"
They changed substantially from one to the other.
And their mouths didn't move either.
Yeah, the mouths didn't move either.
Well, and that's the thing, is the Silurians in the Silurians, the mouths move. In the Sea Devils, the mouth moves. Suddenly we get to Warriors of the Deep, and neither species' mouth moves anymore.
It's almost an instance of like, okay, you've had 10, 20 years in between these that you could have done something really cool with it. Why hasn't the technology advanced a little bit beyond that? It's like Jaws 4. Why is it the worst looking one of the bunch? Surely the shark should look cooler than this by now. And it really was a letdown in some ways. I think they did re-sculpt the Silurian costumes. We talked about the ridges on the backs. They made them look a little bit more reptilian, a little aesthetics.
Maybe more dinosaur-like.
Yeah, a little stegosaurus.
Yeah.
Which in some ways was cool. But then when you take away the elements of them that, maybe because you can't do that. Now, you printed this off from Wikipedia. I just want to cover this real quick production-wise. Early in the production part of the story, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher announced an early parliamentary election. This created a sudden demand for BBC studio space, and as a result, the production schedule for the story unexpectedly lost 2 weeks. Production was completed, but many signs of the hurried production are evident. Many scenes had little or no rehearsal, many scenes received only one take, and perhaps the biggest problem came with the Murka costume. It was completed only an hour or so before it was scheduled to be used. The two puppeteers inside could not be fitted and had no time to rehearse. The costume smelled strongly of paint and adhesive, which one puppeteer said made him feel like he was sniffing glue. The paint on the costume had not dried by the time filming started,
and tended to rub off on the sets and other costumes, as can be spotted in several scenes.
I think there that explains I need a lot. I need to go back and look, because there's at one point that the doctor brushes... Oh, this is we talked about costume, but at one point the doctor brushes up against the Murka. And I swear when he's done, there's a little smudge of green on there. And I thought maybe I imagined that, but perhaps reading that...
Oh, that might have been paint.
Yeah, paint. But we talked
it's the
about
way the marker keeps score. You are so out of the game, you've got green on you. I can tell from here. You should be electrocuted and dead.
And this is one of those times that you know, we talked about when the doctor's out of costume, when he's out of his normal clothes, it's just almost weird to see the doctor out of place. And in two-thirds of this
three of the four episodes.
Story arc, he is in this suit because his clothes get wet when he's knocked into the water and presumed to be drowned, which...
Which was a fantastic-looking dive and dummy when it fell into the water.
It wasn't a dummy. It was actually a man. It was actually a stuntman. He just went pretty limp, I guess. I don't know.
Really limp. they must have literally knocked him unconscious when they knocked him.
I was really shocked when that stunt happened because I was not expecting there to be water beneath. The establishing shot of that room, it made it look like it was a concrete floor. Yeah. And when he went up and over the rail, I was actually concerned.
Because
it was like, whoa!
The water is very still.
Yeah. And he hit and then sank. It was like, oh, okay. I just, but yeah, not necessarily the strongest John Pertwee story. And you're right, the companions, Turgon and Teela, Turlo and Tegan, really not given much to do.
And Turlo is the woman, right?
No, Tegan's the woman.
Tegan's the woman. Okay.
Turlo's the ginger.
You could tell it was in the 80s from her.
Her outfit, her outfit, hairstyle.
Her hair. Oh, she was trying to look like, oh, I can't even remember who now.
Linda Carlo?
Jim.
Anybody from the 80s.
Anybody from the 80s.
I mean, yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
I think the most disappointing thing from the, I mean, we talked, we enjoyed it because we have a tendency to enjoy things that, like this. Yeah. Right? But it really... dumbed down and in a lot of ways nearly destroyed the established setup that we all enjoyed that was so good about the Silurians and the Sea Devils. Just the work that they had put into making these established races do what they did and how they interacted and were working together or whatever. The work that they had set up with trying to make that, even though later been established much real-world anthropological and archaeological inaccuracies.
Right.
But they worked very hard to try and set something up that was plausible. And then this episode comes along, and they just kind of dismiss 90% of it and say, hey, look, we brought back a classic monster.
No, we brought back two classic monsters.
At the same time.
And they're working together.
Yeah. Just, Murka aside, it really felt not quite so cool.
The story is there. The story, if you look at it between the lines, between the bad parts of the episodes, the story is good. I like the idea of the two coming together, working together. You know, clearly it's 80-some years later after we've visited the Silurians, at least. And, it's more than that.
It's 100 years.
100 years later. I like that idea. I like, again, we've got the Doctor wanting to broker peace and stop the war and say, you know, this can't happen. You guys can live together. We've got this whole dynamic again. And the whole decision that the Doctor has to make to go ahead and utilize the gas that they found, which...
hexachromite.
Hexachromite gas, which I looked up, doesn't really exist. It was made up for Dr.
I'm so disappointed.
Not the same thing.
Now what are we going to do when the Sea Devils come after us?
Yeah, but so...
There's a lot of it that worked.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that it's 2084 and there's still two warring factions on the planet, which they don't name, which I thought was genius.
Just two warring superpowers.
That we're going to leave it at that. We talked about the sets. The sea base, I know a lot of the reviews that I've seen online, they complained that it wasn't dark and claustrophobic and cramped. And I agree with that.
It's lit, very sterile. And it's white and it's sterile.
But it's still impressive.
It is. It really is.
For an undersea base, it looks great. The prop work that was done with the spaceships and the orbiting satellite, and I mean, all of that really brought back, wow. I mean, there were some impressive things that were done with this episode from a physical standpoint.
The ultraviolet beam.
One of the things I did appreciate was the fact that they didn't try to stretch out the story so much more than necessary.
Yeah, and a lot of times I think as the show went on, and part of it is as the audience has progressed, that maybe we didn't feel that we needed to create such a big, epic, long story arc if it didn't call for it. And we've talked about the...
Well, and I think shooting schedules were a lot more truncated in that time, and clearly seasons, I think, were shorter at that point, mm-hmm. and so they narrowed the scope and got more stories in with less time.
But it also gave it a little more pacing.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't as much dead exposition mm-hmm. as there was, let's go run into the next room and see what's going to happen now.
Right.
And
or take an entire episode to figure out the antidote for a virus that's been released on the world.
I liked the fact that the Doctor was so very reluctant to commit to a course of action, almost to the point where it's like, dude, seriously, come on. I mean, we've got trouble here. You've got to fix this, and otherwise you're going to wipe out the whole planet. But just the fact that he was very, very reluctant to do it. And then we talked pre-show about the fact that this triad idea of this Solarian leader who remembers him, but yet wasn't in the Silurian episode. And we established that there weren't any Silurians in the Sea Devils. Mm-hmm. So when did this happen? When did the Doctor meet this guy and this idea of the triad and that these are the last of this particular cell? And we don't know.
Nothing televised as far as that continuity goes. And I haven't read any of them, but I know there's some of the New Adventure novels that did deal with Solarians. I don't know if that's ever mentioned in there, but everybody knows that canon does not cross over between the two.
Right.
That within the continuity, that's up to the fan as to how continuity works within the different realms of Doctor Who. But
if anybody knows, it could have been alluded to
from that. Might have been something a writer picked up somewhere else. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't. I had when we first watched it, I had sort of thought that this faction was at least the leader was the guy that was put in charge by the younger Solarian. When he said, the younger Solarian, after killing the older Solarian earlier, becoming the new leader, said, I'll stay out here while you guys rehibernate to oversee the process. And he tasked that next Silurian as being the next leader and carrying on what he was trying to do.
You'll be dead, well, then you'll be leader.
Yeah, and so when, what do they call him?
Iktar.
Iktar. I just assumed Iktar was that character.
Did they ever name?
But they never talked about a triad.
None of the characters in the Silurians.
The Silurians were ever named. Yeah.
So, it's still possible.
Retconning it, that could have been who that was. Yeah. Although he sounds different, he's got a different voice. But maybe that's
hibernation sickness can do that. Or he's just older now.
There's also jumping back to the TARDIS and the fact that we get the TARDIS. This is your first view of the classic era console room.
Yeah.
Which was quite different from what's in the new series,
and especially just comparing the sets from this to the Silurian episodes, we actually had buttons that did stuff and monitors that actually they showed us the mm-hmm. monitors and stuff. And I was pretty,
although some of them were missile command.
Yeah,
that's true. I was pretty impressed with the console room of the TARDIS, and they needed to take the TARDIS through a car wash or something because it was a little dingy. But
and apparently the lock didn't work either.
Well, yeah. They just didn't close the door all the way.
Who was the last person out of the TARDIS?
I don't remember.
We'll have to go back and look.
Negative
flogging. Blame for leaving the door open.
Did we ever figure out if those two guys that wandered back in the TARDIS ever came back out?
No, they never showed.
Well, and from a continuity standpoint, Chameleon was part of the crew at this point.
Correct.
But not in this episode.
And no explanation as to why he's not in this episode.
So he's probably serving tea now, to the two guys that wandered
exactly.
back.
Exactly. Maybe he's the security system. interestingly enough, I mean, we obviously know the off-camera reason why he's not in that episode is the prop just simply did not work. And probably was originally slated to be in that one, but that's a discussion for another time as we talk about the Chameleon as a companion.
So we've got that ends a monster file type
it does.
Episode for us.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
And
I'll go back and say it again. I will definitely buy this box set, even though Warriors is the weakest of the three, because I want to see the extras. I want to pick up the...
I'd be interested in owning the Solarians if I could just get the Solarians.
Yeah.
I would be interested in owning that one.
I think you can purchase them individually. But, yeah, I would definitely buy the box set just because I'm a completist for one thing. But they're all strong stories, warriors being... Not, maybe not strong, but, you know, having potential.
If I didn't have to worry about the BBC coming after me, I would start marketing plush Mercas. that's going to be my...
Oh,
that's going to be the Sarah, next big...
That's Sarah's next task. We've got to get her to make a Merca. Okay. Well, that's the other thing I have to mention is that when we watched this, I tweeted out that we were laughing at the Merker and spelled it, I believe it,
M-U-R-K-E-R.
We spelled it like Merkin,
yeah.
But with E-R instead
exactly.
of I-N.
And then realized later when we were looking it up online, it's actually Merka, M-Y-R-K-A, which then from then on I was typing it out that way. But I'll tell you what throws you off is, and New Yorkers have this same accent, is anything that ends with an A in some British regions, they sound like they're adding an R to it. And so it really, for the longest time, I thought it was Merker.
I'm still not convinced they're not Darlax.
Yeah.
That's as a kid, that's how I grew up with it, and that's what we called them. And it was jarring to see it in print the first time ago. Really?
How about Solarians? Now I'm going to go back to
Solarians.
Solarians, yeah. We were saying Solarians for so long, and it's Silurians, you know. So, it's just interesting, the pronunciations that we get on that, so... Anyway, anyone who followed that first tweet, you'll realize that I spelled it wrong, but we got it right later. So
this, now that we've cleared this up, you have a green light now to jump back, and Keith's been,
woo-hoo!
He's been champing at the bit, just waiting.
I have resisted from watching any more season 5, although you guys gave me permission last week, I still went ahead and waited.
Okay.
Partially because... I didn't have the time
plate.
To. three and a half episodes of and the Solarians was...
Well, on Wednesday when we realized, oh wait, there are 7 episodes of the Silurians, and at the time I thought there were 7 episodes of the Sea Devils as well, but there's actually only 6.
Oh, because that 20 minutes makes a big difference.
So
we planned to get together as a group and view all 3 of these originally was the plan, and then when we began to realize... how many hours of television we were talking.
That was really too much time to spend together.
We kind of...
Even though we spent hours afterwards playing Rock
Absolutely,
Band together.
Yeah, yeah.
And speaking of Rock Band, just a little further note on the challenge. We obviously have some pictures posted of the David Tennant. I'm disappointed in all of you who haven't submitted anything yet. I'm hoping that you'll get inspired and throw some more stuff up there because we're geeky enough to think that's cool. So please.
I started looking into Band Hero to see if I could create a Matt Smith. Can't do it. I could do a Eccleston, but I couldn't do a Matt Smith. They don't have.
We may have to get her Eccleston that way since the jacket.
The jacket disappointed me. I was. But yeah, Keith's ready now to start watching or he's going to probably finish off.
We'll finish the season next week.
4 episodes of Matt Smith's. Season 5.
And hopefully that will carry us over to the following week then when hopefully we'll all have a copy of the movie. Well, 2 of us will at least have a copy of the movie in our hands. One of us will be borrowing it, but we'll have that hot little movie in our hands and get that one watched and reviewed too.
Beyond excited.
Oh,
I'm beside myself. I'm so excited.
Me too.
For Paul McGann.
Absolutely. Anyway, so
we'll put up a new poll as soon as this last one finishes up. Last I looked, it had 23 hours to go on it. And
the question on that was?
The question was, does Matt Smith have emo hair? We have 4 votes so far. 1 yes, that one coming from Sean. 2 no's, and 1 what's emo hair?
Which doesn't really count because that's my post because somehow the poll got reset and I had to test it and that was the only way I could do it.
But right now, the overwhelming response... Well, not overwhelming, I guess, but the response so far has been no.
The 2-1 is such an overwhelming response.
Yes.
It's 2-1.
Victory!
I
think the
next
poll we'll change it to is...
Hang on. This is a side note, but it's very, very interesting, because after we made that conversation last week about Matt Smith has emo hair and Keith has emo hair, I'd said this, and Keith got defensive and said, no, he doesn't have emo hair. I kid you not, the next time I see Keith, he has a haircut. the emo hair went away.
Yeah, and Sean Glenn took the picture that's on me on the blog
the day before
I got my haircut. And I wasn't intending
to get... It was still styled differently.
But no, that's how I normally style it.
Oh, you had
that is
thing over.
I try. I didn't intend to get my hair cut the way I did. I just sat down and was like, I want to do something different. Not even thinking about the emo hair stuff. And I was like, just go to town.
Well, the other thing I think is interesting is that after we corrected the rock band David Tennant, the next time I see you, you show up to my house with the David Tennant haircut. You had the whole...
I put up a faux hawk.
A faux hawk thing going on. And I just thought to myself, my God, you're malleable. I'm going to start planting, you know, other nefarious subliminal suggestions in your ear. So,
For the next poll, we'll set it up as what's the next classic monster we should review,
and
we'll set that up for a little longer than we have been. We'll set it up for at least a 2-week poll. So hop on our website and vote on that, travelingthevortex.blogspot.com.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, I think it's going to do it for us this week. We went a little longer than we intended, but we had a bulk of episodes to cover.
Maybe
so
we have to break it.
Hopefully,
into parts.
Yeah. Hopefully, forgive us for the lengthy episode. But for now, we're going to sign out. I'm Keith. I'm Keith. I'm Glenn.
Really, you are.
I looked at Keith. Wow. Hey, I'm Keith.
Can I be Glenn?
Yeah, I'm Sean.
Anyway, I'm Glenn.
I'm Sean.
I'm Keith.
Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Traveling the Vortex. Doctor Who and all of its associated programs are owned and trademarked by the BBC. No infringement is intended or implied.